With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. This week I'm speaking to Nick Manning, who was one of the co-founders of Manning Gottlieb OMD, one of the world's most well-known and highly regarded agencies. Nick was also the CSO of Ubiquity for over a decade. Nick is one of those people in the industry I particularly like in that they really care about making the industry better. And he has set up a new industry movement, along with Brian Jacobs, who is another stalwart of the agency scene. The movement's called Advertising Who Cares. We talk about what drove Nick to kick things off, what he thinks is broken, and how we can go about fixing it. And, you know, I think an important vision for the movement is also, you know, how do we make this industry more attractive to young people coming into it? Firstly, just a little bit of housekeeping from us. On the event side, we have VideoRise, which is a video advertising leadership forum that's coming up in Prague in May. It'll go from May 13th to the 15th. And if you're a leader in the advertising space, this one's for you. It's typically about 40 to 50 people. The Rise events are by far my personal favorite of all our events. And for what they lack in scale, I know that 40 to 50 people can often seem like quite a relatively small number compared to our larger events. They're hugely impactful. You get deep personal relationships with many of the industry's key people. And when I say deep personal relationships, I mean typically these so often emerge as friendships. You also get real meaningful business impact, I think, if you use the event correctly. And there's a lot of fun and interactivity and lots of chances to participate along the way. So yeah, that one's in May. VideoRise.com is the website. Then we'll also be in Cannes in June, of course, and we'll be working with a number of companies on various activations. We'd love to be working with you. So if you'd like to be partnering with us in Cannes and feature as part of our coverage for the week, please get in touch either via the Video Week website or always feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn or to drop me an email at vincent@videoweek.com or partnerships@videoweek.com. Now, I'll cross over to my conversation with Nick, and I hope you enjoy. So, Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Well, yeah, delighted to have you on. To be honest, when I first invited you, I was a little bit confused about how this hasn't happened already, but here we are. Anyway, so, I mean, you've had a very illustrious career in advertising, I think it's fair to say. Be good if you could start by just giving us a bit of background on how you first got into the industry and then, what you went on to do.
Well, it's a very good question, Vincent. And I got into media completely by accident. And 44 years later, I have no particular regrets about the accident. But I tried to get it. Well, I studied modern languages at university. I did Spanish and French. And the careers people at the university said, "Oh, you know, you should go into advertising or insurance broking." Those seemed to be the only things that they knew about. Incredibly, back in those days. So I tried to get into advertising via the usual route. I applied for graduate jobs at the big creative agencies like BMP, Abbott Mead Vickers, and those kind of people, and failed miserably for all for good reasons, actually. And then one day, a friend of mine who was working at one of the TV stations selling airtime told me about a company he was dealing with who were looking for somebody to buy airtime. And I didn't know anything about that, but I went along for the interview and got in. And actually, it was quite interesting because when my interviewer said to me, "You know, what are your educational qualifications?" and I reeled them off, he said, "You're probably overqualified." for this. We don't we normally take on school leavers and train them up. And I said, well, I'm, pretend I'm a school leaver. I'm happy to do this. And here we are all these years later. I started out as a trainee television buyer at a company called Chris Ingram Associates a long, long, long time ago. And that was the start. And it's sort of gone on from there, really.
So, I mean, come on, tell us about what you built and your other roles.
Well, the so that I guess it divides into three phases. There was well, there was after 10 years of training, if you like, doing the an apprenticeship, I suppose you'd still call it. That's when Colin Gottlieb and I set up our agency, Manning Gottlieb, Manning Gottlieb Media, as it was at the time. Built that up with the help of a creative agency, one of the best of the time. And with the help of Cara, who were called TMD Cara at the time, and we had enormous success. I mean, it was it was a great combination. We were doing something different in the marketplace as well. We were trying to make media more interesting, more imaginative, more creative, and worked very, very closely with a number of creative agencies, not just our sponsoring creative agency. So, for example, we did an enormous amount of work on Nike with them. But also on Virgin with others who were some of the best creative agencies at the time. So we became very much in the vanguard of having creative and media together, back together in some ways. And our job was to amplify the creative messaging, make it work harder, reach the right people, make more noise, and all that sort of stuff, which was our stock in trade. And that was in contrast to what was happening at the time when media was becoming commoditized and it was all about buying and discounts and clout and all that sort of stuff. So we zagged while other people were zigging and continued doing that. And in fact, the agency we founded, which is now called Manning Gottlieb OMD, of course, is still doing pretty much that in a modern context and scoops, all the awards and wins a lot of business because they still carry the torch, if you like, for media creativity. So it shows that DNA can survive even though the founders have long gone.
Yes, it is very much still an ongoing success story. So, yeah, well done for creating a sustainable business. No easy task in this industry. So, you've created a new project, advertising. Who cares? Question mark. I mean, what is it exactly? I mean, how would you define it as a group, a movement? And what are the aims?
Yes, well, it is the question on everybody's lips when they speak to us at the moment. It's a grassroots movement. It's deliberately not a formal thing. It's not a company. It's not even a charity. It's not anything. It's an association of like-minded individuals who all care about advertising and the direction that the advertising industry is going in. But we also care about the advertising industry as a place for people to work. We believe that the advertising industry should provide enjoyment as well as employment. That was certainly the case when I was coming up through the ranks, as it were. But we don't believe that is quite so much the case anymore. I mean, it's not as though there's a lot of people who enjoy what they're doing, et cetera, but the lot of people we speak to say that it's not as rewarding a place to be as it used to be, and the data tells us that from a purely financial standpoint, that is absolutely not the case, and salaries have stagnated now. So just to give you a sense of that, Vincent, when I left the OMD Group in 2007, the starting salaries for people joining us then were about £25,000 a year. And now they are £25,000 a year. That was 17 years ago, and we all know what's happened to the cost of living in the last 17 years. So, from a purely practical standpoint, if you want to join an industry right now, this isn't necessarily the right place, the one to join if you've got other alternatives, or you can go and work for an ad tech company and earn a lot more than that. Or frankly, you can go and work for a broadcaster or a publisher and a lot more than that. So, It's not as rewarding an industry as it used to be, both in terms of the quality of life and the commercial return of that. And when you look at what's happened to the cost of accommodation, rent in London in particular is through the roof. That's a pun, I suppose. And that's true in all of the major conurbations throughout the world. Then it's very difficult for people coming into the industry to be able to afford the things that they need to afford. So we care about advertising, and we also care about the advertising industry, and the movement is designed to improve both.
So outside of pay, and I think pay is very much an ongoing issue and very much something that's, yeah, we've had a period of wage stagnation across the UK economy. So I wouldn't have a huge amount of hope for people being able to find better opportunities elsewhere, but I'm sure there are pockets, certainly. But I mean, you've identified five sort of high level areas to focus on. Do you want to maybe give us a walk through those?
Well, in fact, that number has expanded now. We started with five earlier this year, and we've actually now alighted on, well, I'm going to say roughly seven. It's seven at the moment. But so let me talk about the seven in particular, and I'll give you a thumbnail sketch of each. But if we just go back one little bit, the question is, why are we doing any of this? If we were in a room and people were speaking privately rather than with their commercial heads on, basically speaking for themselves, not their employers, and you said to that room, are you happy with the state of advertising and the state of the advertising industry right now? And raise your hands if that is the case, then I think everybody in the room would raise their hands. I mean, there will be exceptions, maybe, but people, we talk to people off the record and often on the record and say, what do you think that advertising is in a good place right now? And hardly anybody else does. And the reasons for that are that advertising now is, well, it's in excess. People are being bombarded by it. It is supposed to have become by now more relevant and personalized, but that isn't necessarily the case. In fact, it's surprising how little personalized advertising the average person sees in the course of a day or hears in the course of a day. And people feel bombarded, as I say, bombarded by it. And what's happened is that has eroded people's view of the advertising world, of advertising itself. It's eroded their trust in it. And we've taken the consumer for granted. We've bombarded them too much. We've abused their privacy. We've tracked them and used various data techniques to try and sneak up on them. The internet has done a fantastic job at democratizing lots of things, but it has led to a massive oversupply of advertising. If you as a consumer, and we're all consumers first and foremost, if you just go onto a web page for your favorite website, unless you're a subscriber to behind a paywall or whatever, there's a good chance that you will be instantly bombarded by flashing banners and all sorts of it's sometimes just incredibly intrusive and annoying content. And that is the day-to-day experience of people of advertising. Forget the awards, forget all the creative work that's good out there. We're talking about everybody's day-to-day experience of advertising. So we want to try and get back to a better equilibrium where advertising doesn't bombard or intrude, it doesn't invade people's privacy. And we want to get back to a world where advertising is more effective. I mean, effectiveness has declined with all the things we're talking about here. That can be tracked through many data points, but the general trend is that advertising spend is less effective than it used to be. So that's the basis of where we're coming from. I realize that there's a chance I'm going to speak forever here, but that's when we talk about the seven pillars of wisdom. Which we're going to be talking about, that the end goal is to address that point.
So I think most people listening, will relate to pretty much everything that you've just said. There's lots to take on, and I mean, we're going to dig into the detail as we go on, but at a high level, I mean, what's the best way of going about resolving these issues? I mean, a lot of these issues are, people have had awareness, so I wouldn't be convinced that, generating awareness is necessarily the answer. But the what's I mean, it's certainly a starting point, but what's the, how can we go about disentangling everything that you've just been talking about?
So how do we reconstruct all of this? So let me talk first of all about some of the pillars. We'll talk about all seven if we have time. But let's talk about the most important ones. So the first one to talk about is the one that people don't want to talk about generally, is the business models in the industry. And we could spend the entire podcast just talking about this. We shouldn't, but we could. So let's talk about what we mean by business models. We also talk about misaligned incentives. We talk about the way that money is made in both legitimate ways and illegitimate ways. So when we had our launch event back in September, we had Michael Farmer, who is the doyen of the business model world, talking about the problems of the business model within agencies and advertisers as well. And I'm going to talk about that in just a second. What he didn't talk about, because he doesn't really specialize in this, is the business models of the ad tech and platform industry, which we are going to talk about. So it's not that Michael wasn't talking about it, it's just that it's not the area he specializes in. He tends to look more at the advertisement agency side of things, what you might describe as the buy side of the industry as opposed to the sell side. So let's, if you don't mind, we can talk a bit about that, and then I can tell you how that cascades down into everything else.
Where should we start? I mean, the advertiser seems like the obvious starting point for me.
It is. And so, and this is, none of this is necessarily brand new information, but the data is quite stark. But it's also an area that people don't like to talk about too much, because part of the problem that we have can be laid at the door of the advertisers themselves. And Michael's presentation was very clear on this, and there was a lot of supporting data. But he talked about the fact that if you actually look at the large corporations now, and particularly in the US, and especially in the areas of consumer packaged goods and financial services, and the big traditional advertisers, the ones who have propped up the advertising industry for decades. So we're not necessarily talking about the tech sector here. That's a completely separate conversation in some ways. But if you look at what's happened to their sales and revenues over the last 10 years or so, they have plateaued. In fact, they've barely moved at all. The growth has been very, very low. But stock prices have moved up quite sharply. And there are various reasons for that. One is that they've used financial engineering like share buybacks in order to manage that process, which is a perfectly legitimate business methodology. Although, there are all sorts of questions around the wisdom of some of that. But the other thing they've done is they have tried to squeeze cost out of their businesses to a fairly dramatic extent. And one of the areas that they have hit quite hard is the marketing, advertising, and media side of their P&L. And they've done that through a number of means, really, and aggressive procurement is part of that. And I'm deliberately saying aggressive procurement, because procurement is not in and of itself a bad thing, of course, but it depends how you do it and what the outcomes are. And so it is not unknown for procurement departments in large corporations to effectively see their main job when it comes to marketing, advertising, and media to reduce cost. Surprise, surprise, because that's the way that they're incentivized. It's the way that they get rewarded and promoted and bonused and all that sort of stuff. So that tendency to cut cost leads to economies throughout the whole of the advertising, marketing, and media system, that places a lot of pressure upon the their commercial partners within the within that sphere. So agencies and ad tech and everybody else, it was like they see the downstream effects of that, and they put a lot of pressure on agencies. And I'm you know I know of many instances where clients have said to media agency bosses at a very high level, you know, I want you to produce an incredible performance for me, and I'm not going to ask too many questions about how you do it. So that has an effect on how the media agencies operate as well. I'm not saying that is absolutely the case in every instance, but it certainly happens.
Just on that on that topic, I'm just curious about whether these are actual financial outcomes in terms of results, or are these pretty numbers on a spreadsheet that look, you know, favorable to the CFO in terms of KPIs?
Very much the latter, because it's quite easy in some ways to come up with a set of numbers which looks on the surface to be very attractive. Let me give you one practical example. So let's take principal-based media, otherwise known as proprietary or inventory media, which you and I have spoken about before, but is growing like Japanese knotweed right now. And one of the reasons for that is because the agency groups, who are, by the way, very intelligent people, are able to dress up that way of trading, which essentially means reselling media to their clients, bundled up with data and other benefits, reselling that to their clients in a way that says, we're not going to charge you a fee. And sometimes it's a, you know, there is no fee being charged for a period of time, but we are going to earn money from the way that we trade in the marketplace. So you won't have any fees. That means you can re-identify working versus non-working monies. In other words, it's all working because non-working monies means fees, and everybody wants to reduce fees. And by describing it as working money, it sounds far, far better. Now we can go into the ins and outs of principal-based media, and again, I could talk about that for several hours, but won't. But I'm trying to describe here the kind of client behavior that then drives agency behavior. And then once one agency group does that kind of thing, they all do that kind of thing because they can make more margin out of doing that. They are egged on to do it by the analyst community because they say, well, you know, agency group A is doing more of this. Why don't you do more of this? IPG being the obvious case there. The reason that the big groups have to do that is not just to provide what the clients are asking them for, of course, because but the clients are. It's also to prop up their declining margins. So in the big holding companies, the creative margins are being dramatically eroded. The big retainers are no longer there. The big production budgets are no longer there. You know, the data says, and there's plenty of data to prove this, is that the big creative agencies are hemorrhaging money. So within the holding companies, the media agencies have got to take up the slack and find replacement revenues and profit in order to compensate for that. This is not a secret. It's not new even, but it's something that doesn't get talked about very much. Madison and Wall put out some numbers on this the other day to show that within one of the holding companies, the creative agency revenues were down by a significant amount, and the media agency revenues were up by a significant amount to compensate for it. So you know, client behavior cascades down and affects the agencies, but the agencies are also affected, of course, by other things, including the arrival of AI, which we will come on and talk about in a minute a bit more, but also the move towards clients doing it for themselves. Not to mention the fact that the advertising industry doesn't just comprise big brands anymore. It's also got an incredibly long tail of other advertisers who are spending money mostly on social and other digital platforms, and they're doing it for themselves or they're using independent agencies. So I'm going to stop talking for a bit now, otherwise people are going to get bored of the sound of my voice, and give you a chance to sort of.
I'm just mindful that there might be somebody listening. So, principal media has various different terms, and people might encounter it in different ways or under branded products. But essentially, it's an agency often using their sizable scale by aggregating lots of spend to go out, often buy media in advance and then to sell it to their clients at a profit. And I mean, what are the you've been quite outspoken on principal media in the past. You know, one person might say, well, you know, that they're simply creating a product that they are selling to clients at an agreed price. What are the main issues around principal media, do you think?
Yes, well, if you've got half an hour spare, Vincent, no, I'll try and keep it because it is the subject of the moment, and I am talking and writing and speaking about it an awful lot, and I'm conscious of the fact that we have lots to get through here. But I disagree with it in principle and in practice. In principle, the idea that you employ a trusted advisor to work on your behalf, who then says, yes, but I can work on your behalf, but I'm going to earn money in ways that you won't know about and you're not allowed to know about. You can't audit them. Just don't ask me to tell you how. And you know, it's almost like going to a, you know, if you're investing in your own personal money into something where your broker says, oh, I can get a better return from you, but I'm not going to tell you how. You just have to not ask any questions. And I think that's just a bad thing. It erodes trust. It creates an imbalance in the client-agency relationship. It means that clients who say, I don't want to do this, thank you very much, arguably get less than from clients who do. So you create a two-track system within the agency community and the client community. And it does lead to short-termism because, well, if you're saying, okay, I can get you all this year by trading this way, next year the client will think, well, actually, if they can do that this year, let's put it out to tender for next year and see who buys. So it can lead to, you know, more reviews and more of a commoditization of the industry.
An obvious quick fix, and I'm probably going to sound very naive in saying this. An obvious quick fix might be for the advertiser to say, look, I know that you're in a competitive landscape where your incentives require you to go down the route of principal media. I'm happy to pay you more money for a completely transparent relationship. And we, you know, have very tight contracts where you get an agreed but more generous percentage on media, and you don't have to do that. This is how I want to operate. Do these conversations not happen, or?
This goes back to client behavior, which was the starting point of this conversation. If you're a procurement person, particularly if you're in a big procurement job, you've got an international remit, you're trying to negotiate many contracts at the same time, you've got multiple providers, you've got a whole matrix of countries to run, etc. And your main task, reporting usually into the CFO, very and not well, never really into CMO, is to make economies, make savings, and reduce the top line, so that it can benefit the bottom line. Now, normally, you would think in marketing, advertising, and media, the way to improve your profit line would be to do media and marketing, advertising better, drive growth, you know, sell more stuff, and so on. But that takes longer. It's harder to read. You can't tell. You can't necessarily read in a straight line from doing advertising better through to increased sales performance. That could be a factor of number of other things, particularly now that we've got, you know, retail media and digital commerce to play with, etc. So all of these things are connected. And one of the things that's important about advertising, who cares, and why we've got our seven pillars, and I'll come on to the others in a minute, is they are all connected, but they all start with the business models, and they start with the business models of the advertisers, which affects the business models of the agency groups, which affects the business models of the broadcasters and publishers. Then you've got the business models of the platforms themselves, which are incredibly influential in all of this, of course, and the business models of the entire ad tech industry, and its various tentacles into all of the digital channels, you know, obviously including open web, walled market, CTV, you know, digital commerce, connect, retail media, and so on. So they're all of these things are like cogs in a wheel. They all rotate and mesh, and they're all interconnected. So one of the things that we're doing with Advertising Who Cares, and I'm glad you asked the question, is to say this is how they're all interconnected, because nobody has yet really done that, but they are, and we will be describing that to people. Now, some of it is going to take quite a bit of getting used to, because the industry does not like to be open about some of these sort of things. But we decided that we couldn't do what we're planning to do without having complete and utter radical transparency of how the industry works, because we can't describe how the industry is going to work better unless we do that. I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. We're not going to say, that we're going to reduce the power of the big platforms anytime soon. Of course, we're not stupid or naive, but we have to be honest and appraise those business models for what they are. And the business models of the advertisers and the business models of the agencies. In order to describe a different world, we have to be radically honest about those business models.
So, I mean, I think we've dug into the advertisers and agencies, and you've mentioned some of the others, but what do the platforms bring to that dynamic then? They're one of the newer entrants to the market, but as you said, that they hold huge sway across the board. So what have they introduced to this industry dynamic so far?
Well, what they've done at the highest level really is they've taken it from being a buy-side industry where the advertisers' interests were paramount and everybody else basically was subservient to that, to being a sell-side industry where the business models of the big platforms effectively dictate the behavior of everybody else, and by which I mean they dictate the behavior of the advertisers themselves, which is partly voluntary, of course. It's nobody's forced to do things, but to a certain extent, they go down the path of using the big platforms, because they believe that is the way to reach and influence people better, which is not untrue. But when it's left unfettered, you can have all sorts of questions about whether spending as much as they do in those platforms is the right thing to do. Obviously, it dictates the ad tech industry, particularly now in connected television, addressable TV, etc., the open web, less so obviously in the conventional walled gardens, because effectively they are at their own ad tech industry. But it also affects the behavior of the agencies. The agencies have become somewhat beholden to the big platforms, both in terms of the analytics that are used, in terms of the incentives that are used by the big platforms to reward agencies. So there was a very interesting piece. I don't know if you saw it the other day, Vincent,
I
by
did.
the Media Math founder talking about the revelations from the DOJ case against Google in terms of how they were using trading incentives to generate additional revenues, which is not news, except the level of forensic detail that's coming out of the DOJ trial is news, in as much as it's giving us a lot more insight into the ways that they do it, not just the fact they do it. We've got things like the sort of best practice funding that people like Facebook use to essentially give agencies revenue per employee who goes through their training scheme, which incentivizes the agency to send everybody through their training scheme. It's and you know there's none of this again is any is going to be any news to your listeners here, but the ad tech industry essentially determines how the rest of the advertising industry works these days, up to and including the advertisers themselves, and up to and including the agencies. And of course, the ad tech industry itself is very much stitched into that fabric.
Why do you think that, that particularly when it comes to social media, why how is that platform being so resilient in spite of new countless controversies? There's barely a week or a day, barely a day goes by where there isn't some hugely significant scandal, whether it's about more inward at an industry level, whether it's about a measurement scandal, data scandal, fine in this market, fine in that market, massive, externalities on wider society, when it comes to, team mental health or whatever else. The list goes on every single day, and yet the money still keeps flowing there. Is it just purely a scale performance game. And I mean, even then, when you talk about scale and performance, you know, measurement metrics are often found to be fiddled, or they've cooked the books in one way or another. And then, you know, I think many it'd be fair to argue that the creative impact is probably questionable in many instances. Why is this persisted in spite of the fact that, like you say, it isn't news to us? We do know about it. So why do you think this sort of train keeps trundling on?
Well, I think this is the $64,000 question, although the figure is more like 64 billion or trillion even. I think there's a number of reasons for it, and you know, this is something that we will dig into more. But I think the main thing is that this perception, well, sorry, the reality is that obviously that social media in particular has now plays an incredibly prominent role in people's lives. We all use it. We all use it all the time, and it, you know, there's no denying the sheer power of social media, and the numbers speak for themselves in terms of daily active users and so on and so forth. But that doesn't necessarily make it a good place to advertise. So I've been saying for a long time now, probably 15 years or more, I said the internet is the most wonderful thing in terms of providing entertainment, information, and you know, everything you could possibly want, particularly now that video is such a big thing. But it isn't necessarily the best place to advertise if you care about reaching people in a way which is effective and engaging, and which gives you a return on investment. People's attention factors obviously have changed a lot, which is why we have Adelaide and we have Amplified Intelligence and Lumen crawling all over that, thank God. And so, you know, people are scrolling through, and what's happened is that advertisers have tried to sort of catch people unawares, you know, that because they realize that people are using these media in the way that they are. The thing to do is, rather than trying to curate your advertising experience, you go, right, let's just throw a lot of stuff at these people and hope some of it sticks. So, and one of the phrases that came out of our launch event was, advertisers have sort of been defeated by the multiplicity of choice. It's almost a case of sort of saying, well, look, you know, personalization and those kind of relevant messaging tactics haven't really worked, if we're being honest about it, although there's still, you know, a lot of people who haven't been that honest about it. And now with the demise of cookies, people are saying, well, let's look at other things. Let's look at context. Let's look at other factors in all of that. But the reality is that advertising on social media, and to a lesser extent search, but mostly social media and other digital platforms, is very difficult to prove the effectiveness of it. But you go, well, that's where the public is. That's where the eyeballs are. That's where people are congregating. So we've got to go over there and find them there. And yet it isn't a great advertising environment. So I think there's a big dichotomy between the internet and its use by people, and its use by advertisers. I think there's a bit of a divide there, and everything that you talked about in terms of metrics is part of that. So I think that conundrum it still exists, and I think the fact that people are now talking about the word curation an awful lot more says an awful lot, which is we need to cut down on the amount of advertising that we throw out there at people. I mean, you know, the data tells you everything you need to know. Just in the open web, 44,000 websites being used by advertisers in the ANA study. And that's just the open web bit, didn't include walled gardens. So people are just spraying and praying it out there, and frankly can't measure the effectiveness of that because there's too much of it. And they don't even know where the advertising's landing or who it's being seen by. They don't know how much ad fraud there is. I could go on, but I need to stop for a bit because you know, I don't want to bore your listeners by droning on.
Let's in terms of ad tech. Okay, we have advertisers, agencies, platforms. Ad tech, obviously, you know, sometimes it overlaps with the platforms, of course. And like as you said earlier, they've sometimes got their own in-house solutions. But ad tech in a broader sense, looking at more in terms of aggregating and making sense of the wider fragmented mess of the internet. What do you think that they've brought to the ecosystem?
Well, I, well, the obviously, ad tech is important in terms of carrying the messaging, the data that they create and process is incredibly important. But the ad tech industry is very large, it's sprawling. There are thousands of different ad tech businesses out there, as we all know. I mean, the Lumascape, well, there's loads of Lumascapes these days, but it, you know, it's out there, been out there for a long time, tells you everything you need to know. And all of those ad tech businesses have to have a business model, they have to earn revenues and profits. So they're all nibbling away in some way or other at the advertiser budget. So let's just go back a stage really, where you go, well, what's happened to advertisers' budgets over the last 20 years is that they've been shaven by people taking off a part of it. So the agencies take off their part, and they're taking off, you know, an even larger part now with print or based media, and the ad tech industry shaves off their share as well as the money flows down from the advertisers down the daisy chain of ad tech, and then of course the publishers obviously at the end of that chain, and as we know, receive you know well 70 cents in the dollar if they're lucky. By the time the ad tech industry has taken its transaction costs, et cetera. And various studies have you know, proven that over the years. And that's before we factor in the loss of ad exposure via ad fraud and poor viewability and geolocation issues and so on. So the advertising budgets that we used to that we used to have a situation where most of it translated into media appearance. That's gradually reduced, such that within most of the new media, a lot of budget is shaven off by the people taking part in this. And the ANA studies have shown this, and as ISBA have done it, AANA have done it in Australia, New Zealand, etc. Unsurprisingly, by the time the budget has been shaved and shaved and shaved, there's less of it actually reaching consumers out there, particularly in those channels affected by ad fraud and poor viewability and so on. So it's not surprising, therefore, that advertising effectiveness has declined because less of the budget is actually reaching people in a meaningful way. And one of the issues with ad tech is that it's predicated on carrying the water through the pipes, as it were, and you're paid per water unit, you know, the CPM model. And when you've got lots of ad tech companies all being paid a share of a CPM model, then and they have to do that to gain their revenues, then the budget is being you know diluted all the way down the line. And because we've had so many IPOs from ad techs, which have been funded by revenue promises and you know the need to create the need to deliver certain numbers, then the temptation is to you know, take more of that budget in order to reach those numbers. So part of the problem in the end is the CPM model. It's the wrong model for advertisers, and it's probably the wrong model for publishers as well, but it's certainly the right model for the ad tech industry.
So, what would you suggest that they move to if they were to move away from a CPM?
Well, it's interesting. There are new models being looked at. I think we have to. I mean, we have to. Well, we also. One of the things we have to accept is that the ad tech industry is almost certainly oversupplied, and I think there will be some shaking out in that to a certain extent. It's also, of course, going back to the big platforms. I mean, Google is the biggest competitor to so many of the other ad tech companies out there. Trade Desk obviously now has a very, very, you know, large share of that as well. I would imagine there needs to be some consolidation because the CPM model, I think, cannot last forever, particularly if the way it works is exposed more. But so there are one or two people now trying to look at different ways of doing this. I'm going to talk about one in a second. But before I do that, I should say that because I'm an investor in it, I need to caveat what I'm saying by the fact that I'm an investor in it. But it's called Swym AI, SWYM.AI, and the swim bit starts with stop wasting your money, and it's looking at the open web ad tech daisy chain in a different way, and it's got different charging methodologies, which is which is quite radical in the marketplace. And I think when we start to really see curation happening in a bigger way, when people start to trim their inclusion lists, and in fact really cut back on the number of sites that they use, which they should do, then I you know, if curation and the reduction in the number of sites we use has an endpoint, it must be surely to arrive at a smaller, better ad tech industry, and the charging mechanisms will need to move at the same time. I wish I knew what the exact answer was, but it's one of the areas, another of the areas that we shall be hopefully looking at when it comes to the Advertising Who Cares program, which we're about to kick off.
I do recall a little bit of buy side smugness in the early days of programmatic, and I think that many of you took a lot of pleasure in telling premium publishers that their premium audiences weren't quite so valuable anymore. And now that we've got, you know, we can reach via cookie targeting, we could reach, you know, the right user, the right place, the right time. And I do feel that, yeah, it wasn't simply ad tech that fueled that. The shift away from premium and away from quality, I felt like it, that there was something on the buy side where, yeah, if I can get that user in the right place at the right time, and even major brands adopting that approach. And I am sensing a retreat from that type of thinking where I think people have started to realize that quality matters. I think, as you said, attention is shining a light on what actually works, and then people are starting to realize that, you know, that cheap CPM was in fact, you know, vaporware or an MPU being served along 300 others on some dodgy website somewhere.
You're right. It's a volume game. It's basically it is in the interest of the platforms and the ad tech industry to pump out trillions of volumes of impressions, where everybody's earning a few cents or a few dollars per impression, and that's part of the problem. And the other problem is that because of the dominance of the walled gardens of big platforms, all of the other publishers scrabble around for revenues, with the exception of those who are very strong brands and or have their own subscription models as well as advertising models, which is obviously another way of doing it. So we're not talking about the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal here. We're talking about just about anybody who relies primarily on advertising for their revenue. They're scrabbling around for crumbs after most of it has been taken by the big platforms. And that is something we hear from publishers all the time, especially after the budget has been reduced by the ad tech and transaction costs, which have eroded that budget by the time it reaches them. And the studies that have been done show this in very stark detail. And yet, as a result of those studies, nothing has changed and nothing has happened. Nobody has done anything different as a result, or rather, very few have, I should probably say. Those studies may, almost need never have happened for all the effect that they've had, which isn't mean to say they shouldn't have been done or that anyone's done the wrong thing. It's just that the supply side, the sell side of the industry, doesn't want it to change. And unfortunately, the media agencies these days are on the sell side, not on the buy side, because they compromised their position when they started to take money from media owners and broadcasters and publishers, dating back to the late 90s. We're talking about some big things here, and we ought to move on to one or two other things that are part of the Advertising Who Cares movement in a second. But everything we've talked about so far, Vincent, is true, is verifiable. The data exists. Everybody kind of knows this stuff. But a lot of it gets ignored, and it gets ignored for commercial reasons and sensitivities. And our plan is to sort of say, before we put things back together again, everybody needs to be 100% clear on how this industry works in order to move forward from here.
So, I mean, just in terms of misaligned incentives, when it comes to publishers or media owners, let's put broadcasters in the same bucket, which is probably a slightly muddled bucket. But, you know, have they, and I'm somebody who I'm quite happy to admit I've a lot of sympathy with publishers and media owners. I think they've had a tough time in difficult circumstances. But equally, I think if we're getting, if we need to be honest with the state of play today, and I see when it comes to online publishers, they're often, every second paragraph they'll sort of throw in another MPU in there, have some little video playing in the bottom corner sometimes. They'll, they're literally just ramming, destroying the user experience effectively. And I mean, then you could look at premium media from the broadcasters, but equally, things like frequency capping, which are perfectly possible to do from a technological perspective, but they seem quite happy to show you the same ad in every ad break for 20, a 24-hour period. And what's your feeling on that? On yeah, how can we incentivize them that they can tweak their model, but actually get rewarded by the rest of the ecosystem if they go down the right path?
Well, the situation you've described is exactly as it is. The truth is that most publishers even and broadcasters are scrabbling around for revenue the whole time, and they're having to sacrifice the user experience in order to get the revenue that they get. And some publishers are worse than others for, in that regard. But if they're reliant upon advertising revenue primarily, then they just have to add extra for, extra units to their pages in order to try and scrape off as much as they can. But they are getting they're getting pennies in the dollar. I mean, it's that this is the problem, is that the money's not flowing down to them, and it's because of the fact that the industry is now one which relies upon eyeballs, not engagement, is the way I talk about it. In other words, let's just throw impressions out there and hope that something happens as a result, as opposed to understanding what effect and impact our advertising is having. So we've moved to a, I mean, in a, sorry, in a way, it's paradoxical, but at a time when we have enormous choice of content and channels as advertisers or agencies, the whole industry has moved to a throw shit at the wall and see how much sticks type of approach to how they do things. So the care and attention that should be applied to advertising in a multipolar world where content and channel is in infinite supply is not there. It's just basically right, let's just throw out impressions and see what happens. And that then damages the potential to measure and account for advertising effectiveness. And every platform's got a slightly different way of doing that. So it's and they're using their own self-serve system, so you are reliant upon the analytics that you get from each of the players. There's hardly any interoperability, as the jargon would have it. So it's a challenge for people to try and understand exactly what's going on. And and Google Analytics and its various versions thereof has become the dominant means of doing that because it was kind of because it's such a volume player in search and social and with YouTube coming in. So you wouldn't start from here, as the old saying goes. What the solutions to that are the next stage of our processes is to sort of say, this is all true, we know it's true, so what does the answer look like? And people keep saying to us, so what's the answer then? And our response is, we're going to tell you that as we go through the next sort of phase of this process, because we're going to go out there and talk to as many people as we can who have a point of view and a solution and ideas about how we re-engineer all of this, and we're going to present it back to everybody when we've done that work. It might take a year, probably will, but that's what we're going to do, and we're looking for different ways of making this work better. We're looking for people who are doing innovative and interesting things. We're interested in the latest techniques for addressing all of the issues that we're talking about here. So we need solutions, we need ideas, because I think everybody agrees that where we are right now is not an acceptable place to be.
It is. I'm just hoping that we've met, reached rock bottom, and absolutely, I'm full of admiration for you, Nick, in grasping this thorny nettle. I'm getting flashbacks to the Northern Ireland peace process, where these seemingly intractable problems. It just seems like a very sort of thick knot, but one that definitely can be untangled. And like I say, I do feel like we're in a place where people are very keen to, see the industry reformed, and it's in everyone's interest, which is, the ultimate North Star, I think, for us. I mean, it feels like everyone's going to have to make compromises. I think in order to get to a better place, I feel like any compromises. I mean, do you think, for example, I feel the advertisers often underrate their power in the market and just how much people do listen to them when they make bold announcements or, various announcements by Mark Pritchard, even just as a standalone advertiser. We will not tolerate this in the future. And you really get a very strong sense of an industry response afterwards. I'm not sure if they necessarily feel that way, I've certainly witnessed it. What's your feeling so far? I mean, let's start with go back to the advertisers. Do they actually care enough about, moving this forward, or are they all, as you mentioned earlier, are they occupied with trying to manage their global business, and squeezing costs is perhaps becoming an even bigger priority, with cost of living and inflation, for example.
Well, there is a disparity between what they say and what they do, and that's true throughout the entire industry. And it's not unusual for any industry to have what they say in public and what they do in private. Let me give you a couple of other examples. So, I'm sure all of the advertisers and all of the big holding companies have got undertakings on their impact on the environment. It'll be in their statements to shareholders. There'll be ESG messaging everywhere, and it will be, we want to get to net zero, yada, yada, yada. And yet, those same advertisers and those same agencies are spraying the open web and walled gardens with an enormous number of impressions every day, none of which is good for the environment. And in fact, AI is going to make that worse because, in terms of the use of servers and the higher use of bandwidth, et cetera, then environmentally things are going to get worse rather than better. So we need to see, and this might be the biggest obstacle of them all, really. We need to see a difference in terms of what people say and what they actually do. And we don't want to call people out specifically and say, you're not doing what you say you're going to do. We won't be pointing fingers or naming names. What we will be saying, though, is if you're going to have an environmental policy as a company, whether you are a big corporate or a holding company or whatever, then you should behave differently. And it's not that these things haven't already been said. I mean, people like the Conscious Advertising Network, Ad Net Zero, and others. Everyone's been trying to sort of bring about change and bring all these issues to the surface, but it hasn't made very much difference yet. And what we're hoping, and by the way, this is a hope rather than an expectation, is that just by raising the volume of this, by bringing all of the people who are saying these things under the same roof, talking to people like the Conscious Advertising Network and others, Advertising Association in the UK, who have been driving Ad Net Zero, what we're trying to do really is raise consciousness of these issues and add a bit of amplification to the voices of the people, because they are quite disparate. So what we're trying to do is to aggregate those voices in a way where there is a higher volume and more people are aware of these issues, and if necessary, put pressure upon some of the people who are doing this to make changes. So there's a pressure group angle to all of this, but we're being realistic about this. I mean, it's a hard job. Commercial considerations will always predominate. People don't want to reduce their revenues or margins because that has a detrimental effect on their share price, all the things we know about. But we can only recommend what we believe the right way to do these things is, and then hope and trust that people will pick up on it. There's no coercion in all of this. The real nub will come when regulation starts to play a bigger role in all of this, because generally speaking, nothing changes much in this world until people are required to make changes as opposed to being asked.
And you mentioned AI there, and particularly in terms of the environmental fallout. But what impact do you think it's going to have across the industry? I've he heard various schools of thought. Speaking to Wesley Terhaar, who's founder at Monks, and his well, w one of his theories was that we might be heading into a world where agencies are a lot smaller, but perhaps more high margin businesses. There's you hear talk of maybe more senior people realizing that they can maybe go to a client, offer them services, but don't necessarily have to ha have the teams of young people who are hands on keyboard essentially in terms of trafficking campaigns or whatever, where AI will suddenly be able to automate a lot of this work. Obviously, there's a big human fallout to all of that. But yeah, what's the feeling on the ground about AI and the impact it's likely to have? It's a big question, I know.
Yes, it is. It is the question of the moment, isn't it? So everybody sort of says, right, we're not very happy with the way things are at the moment. Well, sorry, privately they'll say that, whether it's when it doesn't affect their salary or their whatever. If we think things are bad right now, and some of us do, obviously, then imagine what it's like when AI is responsible for the creation of the content and the distribution of that content, in a way that could be unfettered. We could see things get an awful lot worse. So one of the key things that came out of our launch event was, and this is not a, and this is this has been said a number of times before, but it's another tool in the toolbox. John Hegarty at our event sort of said, look, people were saying stuff like this about when Gutenberg invented the printing press. There's always been innovation in methodologies of doing things, but AI isn't it doesn't have an imagination in the conventional sense. You need to put these tools in the hands of people who do. This applies to the creative industry, obviously, applies to media as well. And there will be companies who embrace it wholesale to create the messaging and distribute that messaging via the usual platforms, and more to come. There's no question that will happen. The issue really is that a good thing for the companies, the brands? Is it a good thing for the industry? And I think he's right to say that the advertising industry probably will be smaller in years to come. Whether he's right to say that there'll be a higher margin for those businesses is very much up for doubt, I would say, because the clients will say, well, if you can use AI to do all these things, why do you need all these people? And those conversations are already starting to happen. And to a certain extent, the big groups have all contributed that themselves by saying, they've been playing top trumps with this. One group says, right, we're going to spend $500 million on AI next year. So group A says that. Group B says, okay, well, we're going to spend $600 million on AI next year. So to a certain extent, they are, they're driving a problem for themselves by saying we're going to use AI. At which point the clients turn around and sort of say, well, in that case, we can reduce your fees and our costs thereby. By using these new tools to create the ads and distribute the ads. And that's where we can head. And we will head there. Well, we're possibly going to head there anyway, but we want to arrest some of that and say, look, that's absolutely fine. The tools are important, but they are only tools. But we need to understand how advertising best uses those tools rather than just saying, oh, we've got the tools now, and let's just do some more spray and pray, except let's crank it up. By another factor, so that we're not trying to sort of this might sound as though we're King Canute trying to hold back the waves here and all this, and we've been accused of being recidivists and wanting to hark back to the old days. It doesn't help that some of us are a bit long in the tooth, yada yada yada. But none of that is true. What we're trying to do is sort of say, advertising when done well in all its forms can be a major benefactor for businesses and causes and services. It can be a major benefactor for the media ecosystem because it provides the funding for that media ecosystem. It can be good at disseminating messages about things like climate change and so on. So we care about the positive things about advertising, And we want to keep it that way while still taking advantage of the various tools available to us to do it. So it's trying to make sure that we don't go down a sort of automation at all costs route, which will just leave us with a worse version of what we've got now.
I mean, even putting AI aside, you know, do you think this industry is an attractive one for a young person? I mean, you just mentioned about the entry level salaries, although I find it hard to imagine how any agency could, you know, increase those significantly without, you know, losing clients. I feel like many of them will be stuck for all the incentives that we've been discussing. How do we go about making the industry, you know, more attractive to a young person coming in, that they feel that they're going to be fairly re rewarded for the work and go on to a sustainable career?
Well, that is a big question. And so one of the strands that we had and was presented at our launch event was Crispin Reid, who's an amazing researcher in this area, conducted studies amongst young folk. Again, I should point out that all of this was completely free of charge. He did it off out of goodwill completely and didn't charge anything. But he interviewed a lot of young people and said, you know, what is your attitude towards advertising these days? And there were some amazing, phrases, things like, why would I want to enter an industry that bombards us with crap all day long? And that was one phrase, but it was part of a general sense that people are not happy with advertising. They don't like it in the way that they used to. And as a result, they don't feel the same, if you like, warmth towards it to make them want to work in it. And then you get down to the money. And you say, well, notwithstanding all of that, would you work in advertising if it was an attractive place to work? And a lot of people would still say yes, because it's a better alternative to some of the other things they could be doing. But we've become uncompetitive. Now, going back to your point about, yeah, but surely if agencies pay more, they become uncompetitive. That rather depends on what you think your profit margins should be. If you're an independent agency, you can choose to determine what your profit margin is. And you can say, I'm not going to make 20%, I'm going to make 17 and a half, or whatever the number is. If you're a quoted company, holding company, or a publicly listed company, you don't have the ability to make those choices to the same extent. So the independent agency sector will probably thrive in many ways, because one of the reasons they will is because they can hire people at higher salaries, maybe get better people, provide a slightly more intimate and better service to clients. And the e-marketer data that was published last week showed the relative positions of the holding companies in terms of share of market versus the independent agencies versus in-housing over a period of time. And the share recorded for the advertising holding companies is in decline. Independent agencies are growing and in-housing is also growing. And I think that is probably the way it's going to continue into the future. So I know one of your questions is, what would you invest in, if you had the money to do that? I think the answer is I would be investing in a new kind of agency that adopted the principles of advertising who cares. It won't appeal to everybody, every client, because there are some clients for whom it's not appropriate, and that's fine. But I think there'll be some clients who say, you know what, I do believe that advertising can do all the things that you describe here, and I want to find people who can do that for me. And that will be a good place to work, because it will be more rewarding work. It'll be working with like-minded people. It will be with a higher purpose in mind. And I think will be the kind of place that will attract talent. But it will need to pay more, and the only way to pay more really is to get your fees right, of course, and I think that will happen a bit more as well, but also maybe have lower expectations on profit margin.
Yeah, I don't want to be too downcast either. I feel like, and I don't think you would, you know, you mentioned that advertising is still an attractive sector for a lot of people, and I think a lot of the young people in the industry are having a great time and doing great work on great things. But there certainly is an intractable, a lot of difficulties across the industry. In terms of your idea for an agency working across all the different types, I think sometimes maybe what's required is, for the advertiser to actually understand the full extent of the dysfunction across the ecosystem. I think that's a very, maybe it's something that can be clearly explained to them and articulated, but I feel like, the agency world, the advertiser world, the platforms, the ad tech, the publisher world, the TV world, having a nuanced understanding of all those, I mean, it's taken me many years to actually grasp what's going on fully in all those areas. And I say fully at a high level. There would be lots of things that go on behind closed doors or within certain products that I've no awareness of. So I think the complexity. So I think in the order for us to get started on this, maybe it's that, yeah, advertiser education on what's happening and how the role that they can play in making the industry better, and then trusting an agency who wants to, get out of the path of best practice until they don't.
Something you just said there is really true. Is that somebody said to us that you've got to realize that for a lot of people in this industry, they love it because it's still the best place to be. It's better than going to do other things. They're working with people they like, they're working on business they like, etc. We're not saying that everybody's bloody miserable and it's terrible, and we're not saying that at all. What we're saying is that the advertising that people are subject to, i.e., the audience see every day, the public see every day, can be improved. We can recreate a better standing for advertising in people's eyes. We can also improve the advertising industry. We can reward people better. We can provide them with better jobs if we do the things that we're planning to recommend that people do. So this isn't about being down so much as in saying there is a better way, and the better way comes from reinventing some of the things that we currently have that most people would say could do with a lot of improvement. And we're not starting from the basis of sort of saying this has all got to be fixed per se. We're saying it should be improved to everybody's benefit. So if we can get to a point where people in the industry are being paid better, which means that they can afford better accommodation, even perhaps might even be able to get on the property ladder at some point. If they can, afford, better holidays, if they can afford better things for their families, if people are have more rewarding work experiences, doing things that they want to do, working in respected environments, high degree of trust, high degree of purpose, and paid well, then we'd all be happy, wouldn't we? Nobody's ever going to vote against that, and that's where we want to get towards. So, everything that we're planning to do is designed to improve. And we can't think why anybody wouldn't want to do that.
Well, I think it's brilliant, and I love the ambition of it, and I do think it's achievable. I don't want to say, talk about things being intractable or unsolvable. I feel like all of this is solvable, and I feel, yeah, the industry is constantly shifting in different directions, and there's no reason that it shouldn't shift in a better direction. I think Lindsay Clay described you as a conscience of the industry, and I think I'd certainly add to that and echo her words. Thanks so much for taking the time, Nick. It's been really enjoyable.
Well, thank you. I mean, we haven't even talked about advertising's role in making the media ecosystem tick. We touched upon it in some respects, but there are so many aspects to this that we will be talking about over the next year or so. And if anybody is listening to this, well, I say if anybody's listening to this, I hope people are, but anybody who wants to get involved, anybody who that where you go, okay, I really care about the role of advertising funding better media, better journalism, better reporting, in any aspect, then please come and join us. We're very open to people's ideas. We started out just saying if you're interested in coming along and talking to us, fine. We're now actually actively going to start talking to people by saying, come and tell us what you think is important and how you're going about doing it. But that doesn't mean to say that we're not interested in people just coming along and saying, I want to get involved in some form or another. We're very open to all of that. We're going to be consulting very widely. We've got over 500 people who've joined us now from all around the world saying we care about this stuff too. Some of them are actively involved, some are passively involved. So, next autumn when we have our second version of this, we hope to have addressed a lot of the things that we've just been talking about. We're on a bit of a journey of exploration here. We don't really know where this is going to lead, but we do know that people have an appetite for it. We think it's something that needs to be done, and we're going to have a damn good go and see what happens.
It's a revolution, Nick. I genuinely think that you've kicked off something where that's going to keep gaining momentum because I agree with you. The private conversations are certainly all suggesting that people want the industry to be better. So it's advertising. Who cares? I believe it's your website. I hope to be at your n next event. Provided sometimes trade press, our presence is always desired or welcomed for understandable reasons, I should add. But yeah, thanks so much for coming on, Nick.
Great pleasure. Well, thank you. And I dare say that we will continue this dialogue into the future.
Well, indeed. Cheers.
All right. Thank you, Prince.